from Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Tuesday, October the 1st, 2019. We're glad to have you with us this morning. Got a good full show for you. Going to start out with a discussion about scams, those pesky callers you get who want to separate you from your money. There's actually going to be a round of phone calls going out from Burlington this morning, but the callers are going to be Governor Phil Scott, Attorney General T.J. Donovan, Greg Marshall-Don, the head of AARP in Vermont, and others who are going to call folks up and say, here's how to avoid scams. So it should be an interesting, I think they're calling it a reverse boiler room, and it'll be a good exercise, I'm sure, and one that'll allow folks to learn some stuff. We're going to learn some stuff in the first half hour of the program this morning from Greg, and I think T.J. Donovan is going to be joining us in a bit as well. And the Attorney General, of course, Greg Marshall-Don, is the head of AARP, as I mentioned, in Vermont. So we'll have a conversation first off with these two gentlemen. And then in the second half hour, I got intrigued the other day. I watched a guy flying a drone over at Lake Elmore. And just yesterday, I saw a note from UVM saying that they are going to be working on drone safety. They have a spatial analysis lab there that has been selected as one of, I believe, 23 institutions around the world participating in an effort to enhance drone safety. Drones are these little devices that people are putting up in the air to take pictures and do other types of things that they do present occasionally some safety issues. So we're going to be talking about that in the second half hour of the program. Later on in the show, Dan Richardson, our good friend of the Dave Graham Show, is going to be stopping by. He, of course, is the former president of the Vermont Bar Association, very active attorney in Montpelier, very knowledgeable about federal law, state law, and he has talked with us in the past about some of the legal dust-ups going on in Washington, and particularly those involving our president and his administration. And, you know, we've had this thing called impeachment in the news for the last several days now, and we're going to be getting Dan Richardson's take on some of that in the second hour of the program this morning. So a lot of good stuff lined up. As always, we welcome your calls. 244-1777 is the local number here in Waterbury, the toll-free number, 1-877-291-8255. So let's get right to it. I want to start off with a discussion about the whole problem of scams that mainly come into people's telephones, sometimes, I guess, online, but we can find out a little bit about that. And they seem to target especially elderly folks. And so a couple people who are very knowledgeable in this area are Attorney General T.J. Donovan. T.J., thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
And Greg Marshall-Don is the, is it executive director? Is that right title, Greg?
Yes, it is.
All right. You are the executive director of the AARP Vermont chapter. And let's start with you, Greg. You're organizing an event this morning, so tell us about it.
Well, this morning we're going to be basically taking a tool of these criminal scammers who target Vermonters, not just the elderly, but frankly all Vermonters, and using a weapon that they use, the telephone, and sort of turning the tables on them and using the phone to reach out to Vermonters across the state to provide fraud prevention messages and to let them know where they can get information about learning how to avoid scams for themselves and, frankly, just as important, their friends and their family and their neighbors. The telephone is a weapon for these particular criminals. In Vermont, more than half of the scams that have been reported to General Donovan's staff represent what we call the imposter scam. So the IRS scam, which is clearly the most prevalent one in our state, the computer tech scam, or commonly referred to as the Microsoft scam, and then also the grandchild imposter scam, which we're seeing growing year in and year out. So more than half of the scams that are reported to General Donovan's office are in this imposter area and predominantly are used the telephone is the way that they get in touch with these people and the way that they begin to take them for hundreds, thousands, and frankly sometimes tens of thousands of dollars. So today's effort, along with Governor Phil Scott and General Donovan and a group of wonderful AARP volunteers, we're going to be calling folks throughout the state, and again, providing them information about how to protect themselves, and really just trying to take one big long day and shine a spotlight on this issue. I spent time over the last several years talking to General Donovan about this, and we know that the only way that we're really going to defeat this problem in Vermont is to raise the education level and raise awareness about how people can protect themselves. General Donovan can speak better than I can about how difficult it is to prosecute these crimes and to get people's money back. So again, today's effort is an opportunity to talk to as many Vermonters as we can, again, using the telephone like these criminals do, and sort of turning the tables on them, Dave.
Yeah, interesting. T.J. Donovan, the Attorney General of the State of Vermont, also on the line with us this morning. How prevalent is this problem? How widespread in Vermont of people getting scammed via the telephone? Is it growing? Are we shrinking it, getting a handle on it? Where are we in the overall picture?
I think it's growing. And when you look at the number of robocalls that are coming into the state, I think there was one study a while ago that said in 1 month, I think it was the month of August in 2018, and I may have that wrong, but it was absurd and obscene that over 4 million robocalls came in. And a lot of those robocalls are scams, and the number is increasing, which says to me, Dave, to answer your question, that they're working.
Huh.
And the issue is, how do we enforce our laws against these scammers, which oftentimes, if not all the times, are out of state? And so one of the best ways that we can address this issue is to partner with a great organization, Greg's organization, AARP, to raise awareness, to share stories, to give people tips about these scams. Because here's the thing, Dave. You talk to Vermonters, everybody has a story. Everybody has a story. Now, the thing is, there's a lot of shame and embarrassment with these stories because people are being scammed, they're losing money, and they're embarrassed, and they don't want to tell their story. The biggest part for me is exactly that, to break down the stigma and the shame in order to have people share their stories so Vermonters are armed with these stories so they can protect themselves.
And Greg mentioned these three types of scams: the IRS scam, the computer tech scam, and the grandchild scam, I guess some people call it. Are those, in fact, the three main techniques here in Vermont, T.J. Donovan, or are there others as well?
Yeah, they are. Yep. And, you know, that IRS / Social Security scam is by far the number one.
Mm-hmm.
Look, out of our consumer assistance program shop, where frankly most Vermonters call, we get 13,000 calls from Vermonters, and by far the largest complaint is that IRS / Social Security scam. And so, you know, the importance of today's event is the number one, the partnership and the collective raising of the awareness of this issue to better protect Vermonters. Because at the end of the day, Dave, and Greg knows this, it's hard to prosecute anybody on this.
Yeah.
And so what we got to do is share our stories and arm Vermonters with the information they need to know to protect themselves. And that's why AARP is doing such a great job.
And so walk me through this IRS, because it is the most common. Let's start with it. IRS Social Security scam. You pick up the phone, it's ringing, you pick it up, and you're likely to hear what?
Well, this is a fear-based scam. So you're likely to hear a person on the other end. Sometimes it can be an automated a call, but it also can be a live person. They will tell you you owe the Social Security, you owe back taxes and Social Security about $6,000, $7,000, $8,000. We've been trying to reach you. If we do not collect that money from you this afternoon, federal agents will come to your house. They'll repossess your home. They'll take your automobile. This IRS scam is fearsome. So it preys largely on older folks, many who live in our rural communities and many who live alone. Isolation is something we're deeply concerned about here, Dave. These folks, don't always have a network of people they can talk to.
Mm-hmm.
So they're scared. They think, maybe I didn't pay my taxes. They rush to the nearest Shaw's or Price Chopper. They get a MoneyGram or a Western Union for $6,000. They put it in the mail, and it's gone.
Yeah.
These scammers use this automated dialing technology, so they may dial 5, 10, 15,000 numbers at the same time. Obviously, they're not going to scam 15,000 people, but if they just scam one or two Vermonters in that spray of phone calls, they've made $6, $12, $15,000 that day. That's pretty good as far as they're concerned. So this is a real fear-based scam. And once people are scared, their normal thought process sort of goes by the wayside. They get scared. They make a bad decision. They take out, usually they're all obviously asking for, these MoneyGrams or these Western Union money checks. They pay the cash for it, they send it out, and they never see their dollars again. General Donovan said, this is the most prevalent scam in Vermont and one that we are working hard with the Attorney General's office and his fantastic people at the Consumer Assistance Program to get on top of and to get information out to our members and the general public across the state.
And I think the cold bucket of water you can throw on this scam is informing people, if I recall correctly, tell me if I have this right, but essentially the IRS will not call you. That's not how they reach out to you, even if you do owe them money.
That's exactly right. You're never going to get a call from the IRS. You're going to get a letter from them, but you're never going to get a call. And I think a couple of things that people have to remember is, because Greg is right, look, this is a fear-based technique, and sometimes taking a deep breath, asking questions, frankly, not picking up the phone, which is kind of a sad commentary on numbers that you don't recognize, is always a good strategy. But always asking questions, taking a deep breath, and understanding that the federal government and the state government is never going to call you and threaten to take your money over the phone. And, a similar scam that was happening a little while ago was a utility scam where same MO, where they would threaten to turn off your electricity, your heat, if you didn't go pay, immediately go get that money order. A lot of people want gift cards. If people are saying get a gift card, that's also, a sign that it's a scam. And so I think people have to kind of take a deep breath, ask questions, and unfortunately, scrutinize the call and start with the question of, is this a scam? And you don't want to make people paranoid, but at the same time, you got to give people information. And look, we are in a new normal of an online world where scams are more and more prevalent, Dave, getting back to your initial question. So the best thing we can do is to partner with AARP and to raise awareness. And as Greg said, flip the script on this.
Yeah. I'll tell you, I've discovered as working as a reporter and as a radio talk show host trying to book guests, I make a ton of phone calls. And essentially, I've discovered in recent years that nobody picks up their phone anymore. I mean, that's the downside of this. I understand why not, because people, especially if they don't immediately recognize my number, I've gotten into the habit, actually, of typically texting somebody first and saying, do you have a few minutes to chat or something like that, But that's just changing social norms, I think, in response to a lot of this. What do you think about that, Greg?
Well, I mean, I think, Dave, as you just noted, they're in... lies part of the problem. It would be really great if Vermonters didn't always have to look at their telephone and think, is the person that's calling me a number I may not recognize or an institution I may not recognize trying to scam me? Nobody wants to live like that, which again is why working with General Donovan and his team and with AARP all across the state, we're trying to get some traction here. But that said, if the caller ID is just a number that says 802, 555-5555, and it's not a number General Donovan said, don't answer the phone. If it is your doctor's office or a friend down the street or Dave Graham calling for, for a quote for a story he's doing or inviting you on his program, that person will leave a message and then you can go ahead and call them back. Today, when we dial out for these calls, there is an irony that we're using the phone to do something that scams folks, again, turning the tables on this. But what folks will see on their screen, on their caller ID is AARP Vermont Fraud Watch Network.
Yeah.
So,
okay. Okay.
They'll know, and they'll be talking to a live person. And again, but you know, we have to figure out a way to break through to people. And one of the things we know from a Department of Justice and AARP survey that we did 3 years ago is that if we can get the message to individuals, whether it's through events or through the telephone by talking to them, those people that receive fraud prevention messages are 50% less likely to be scammed. So
yep.
That's not 100% or 80%, but it's 50%. And if we could cut that, 50% of fraud and scams in Vermont over the next couple of years, that would be a monumental achievement.
Yeah, a couple times I've tried just to, mainly to entertain others in the room with me when a call comes in on this, and I'll do something like, as soon as I figure out it's not a legit call, I'll say something like, okay, Mr. Attorney General, you're tracing now?
Yeah.
And then they hang right up, you know.
Yeah.
Have a little fun sometimes with this garbage,
yeah.
You know. But I also wanted to just cover these other things. What on the computer tech scam, what's that look typically like?
Well, it says that you get a virus and somehow they get into your computer. I'm not sure how. Perhaps Greg knows. But you have to call immediately this number in order to fix your computer, or the virus is going to destroy your computer. Again, this is all fear-based.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know people who have fallen victim to this scam. And, again, it's scary. You know, again, we all work online. We need our computers to engage in a 21st century economy. And when you get this message that your computer has been hacked or there's a virus, instantly you become fearful that you're not going to be able to engage in your work or commerce or any of the other things that, frankly, we do in a 21st century economy.
Mm-hmm.
And so you make this call, and again, when anybody's asking for your bank account or to get a gift card, don't do it, because it's inevitably going to be a scam. And the thing that I find scary, frankly, about this computer scam is the credibility, because it does show up on your computer somehow, which I'm not quite sure how, that, you know, kind of mirrors that you have this virus because you're looking at your computer. And so there's this shred of credibility with this scam, which makes it, I think, particularly devastating. Greg, I don't know how they do it, but
yeah.
It's, you know, look, I can talk about another one where somebody was scammed because they got an email, presumably from the help desk at Microsoft or something, some company.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually a scammer. So again, these are becoming more sophisticated. They seem credible, at least on its face. And again, the need is for Vermonters to really scrutinize these requests, and anything that's asking for money over the phone, I would say don't do it. It's a scam.
Yeah, and I think another signal to people ought to be, if the communication is unexpected.
That's right.
You know, it seems as though you're just going about your day, and all of a sudden, out of the blue, somebody's on the phone, somebody's on your computer, somebody's in your email, sending you weird stuff. I think a good thought to have is to first ask, what are the chances this is a scam?
Right. Yeah, always take a step back, Dave. And I mean, that's really good advice. Usually when people take a step back and take a deep breath, they'll realize, well, you know, 15 minutes ago when I was on my computer, everything was fine.
Right.
Now, this is odd that there's, you know, 15 pop-ups on my computer telling me that there's a virus, and if I don't click this link or call this phone number immediately, you know, it will destroy my computer. As General Donovan was saying, this scam is particularly egregious because what they end up getting is the ISP address for your computer, which is essentially like giving the keys to your car or your home to a criminal.
Yeah.
Once they have that individual ISP address, they own your computer. They go in, not only can they look at your personal email, if you are doing online banking or paying credit cards online, they have information to all that. They have access to your address book and all of your contact information, which is one of the ways they perpetrate the grandchild imposter scam. So once they've got that ISP address, they're in there, and all the information on the hard drive is there for them to use. And there's a lot of stuff that people keep on their computers, and a lot of really personal information, maybe about healthcare issues or issues associated with family that are not meant to be read by anybody except the person that owns a computer and whom they're communicating with. So this is a very, very dangerous scam, which can, you know, really have not just a single impact of losing money, but can also spread itself in other really, really terrible ways to have, you know, really negative impact on others as well. So this one is particularly horrible.
Quickly, because we're running out of time, but I want to cover the grandchild imposter scam too. I think by its name, you can sort of tell what's happening here. But just so people are understand, TJ Donovan, what do you want to tell us about that one?
Well, again, you know, egregious, sophisticated, tugging on people's heartstrings and fear-based, where presumably a grandchild is in some sort of trouble, you know, just got arrested in a foreign country and calls a grandparent, sends an email requesting money in order to get bailed out or some sort of money in order to get them out of some sort of hot water. And there's been stories where, you know, it's been a phone call and you have people say, boy, it sounded like my grandkid, but they couldn't tell. And look, again, I know people personally who have fallen victim to this, or who went to the bank, took out money, and was about to wire the money. I think the grandmother said, let's make one more call.
Mm-hmm.
And thank God they did, because the scam unraveled. But these are smart people. These are sophisticated people. These are highly successful people. But when you get that call from a loved one that they're in trouble, what's our natural reaction? To help.
Sure.
Because we think the best of people, and we want to make sure that we're protecting and helping our loved ones. And so egregious probably is not strong enough of a word for this one. But again, a devastating, effective scam, because it tugs on people's heartstrings.
Yeah, that is it's all really nasty, but that seems to have an especially nasty emotional hook to it that just is quite an unfortunate thing that people are doing out there. They're not going to get me on that real soon because I don't have any grandkids, but I think that one of these days that might happen. So who knows? But anyway, I wanted to bring on a caller, Forbes from Corinth. Good morning, Forbes.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. How are you?
After it's all done and said and possibly reported, what's the next procedural aspect that the attorney generals or any of the legal process, what teeth do they have in this situation?
TJ Donovan.
Well, it's a great question. Unfortunately, as I said at the outset, these are hard cases to prosecute within the state of Vermont, because oftentimes these folks, these scammers, are not in the state of Vermont, and oftentimes, frankly, they're outside of the country. And so you have not only the jurisdictional issue, but you have the investigation, which is hard to get started because you don't know where to look, because these calls are coming in from all over the place, or it's an email. So enforcement's a real issue. I think working with the federal government to address robocalls, to protect Vermonters from the onslaught of robocalls, is a good step. We've asked the federal government to address that issue. I think I'm headed to a robocall summit because people are fed up about this. And so we got to make sure that from a local level, we're doing the work that we've always done well in Vermont, which frankly is community building, which is exactly what we're doing today with ARP, being creative, being innovative, but collectively raising our voice to help our fellow Vermonters, saying, hey, this is what you need to know about these scams. Arm yourself with information so you don't fall victim to these scams. So we really, as I like to say, the best defense is the best offense when it comes to scams, because of the difficulties in enforcing the law against these scam artists.
And Forbes, does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Would there be any possibility of a clearinghouse, such as once they've been identified, that Let's say we did something even within Vermont.
Yeah, I mean, possibly. I mean, I think we really need the help of the federal government here. And I do think you are starting to see some movement, albeit slow, from the federal government, because I think people are fed up. I mean, when you think about a state of 600,000 people and there's 4 million robocalls coming into our state in a 30-day time period, that's ridiculous. Look, that says to me that some of this stuff is successful, right? Because it's just a fishing expedition. Who's going to take the bait on those 4 million calls? And obviously some are, because they keep happening. That's why we need the federal government to act.
All right. Well, Forbes, thank you for the call. I think you asked some good questions, and clearly this is a concern of a lot of Vermonters out there. And we are fast approaching the bottom of the hour break here, so I think I'm going to thank my guests, T.J. Donovan and Greg Marshall. T.J. Donovan, the Attorney General, thank you so much for joining us, and Greg Marshall of AARP as well.
Thanks for having me.
All righty. We will be back after the break here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
Fall. The crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co. to fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
And we are back, and we are talking in this next half hour or so about drones and drone safety. A lot of folks are seeing drones there. A lot of folks are using drones out there. They're helpful in photography. You can get this little flying device up in the air and get some great angles on your favorite foliage shots here this time of year in Vermont. Saw somebody with a drone up at Lake Elmore just on Sunday, and we are happy to say that the University of Vermont is involved in an important effort to work on drone safety. They are one of several institutions around the country that are signing up to join, a sort of virtual center of excellence sponsored by the Federal Aviation Administration. And we have, I didn't even know this, but UVM has something there called the Spatial Analysis Lab, or SAL, and we have Jarlath O'Neill Dunn joining us from there this morning. Do I have that pronunciation right?
Yes, Dave, you do. Good morning. I know it's not an easy name, and it's something that your parents give you, I think, to build character when you're young.
It builds character. That's good. Well, we like character on the Dave Graham Show here in WDEV, FM, and AM. And so I thank you very much for joining me this morning. And I just wondered if you could start out telling us a little bit about this lab at UVM. Again, I had no idea it was there. And what does it usually do?
Yeah, so Spatial Analysis Lab, you'd probably think that we're staring up at the heavens, but in academia, what we refer to spatial analysis is really any type of mapping. And as you know, right, you use Google Maps probably to help you go to somewhere that you've never been before. We're digital mapping people. And when drone technology started coming online to sort of consumers and researchers about 7 or 8 years ago, for us it was very appealing because we had always used satellite imagery and aerial imagery to map the landscape, but that was kind of expensive. You know, you'd have to wait for a satellite to pass over, and in Vermont, just look up today, not a good day for satellite imagery, or maybe you'd have to contract with someone with a plane to get imagery. And so the ability for us to have our own organic imaging systems we could go up and collect data and produce maps from was really appealing, especially following Tropical Storm Irene, where we realized there was a massive shortage of the type of overhead imagery that could allow people to make better decisions.
The this kind of imagery actually, a lot of people are just getting amazing photographs these days with drones. And when did drones come into fashion? When were the drones you're seeing out there now in our parks and on our hillsides start being used a lot?
Yeah, so most of us are probably familiar with drones, and they often have sometimes a negative connotation, right? We've seen them a lot used in wartime specifically, right? And they really did change the game, right? The ability to get real-time data feeds was something new. And then about, sort of 7-8 years ago, we had the miniaturization of a lot of the technology. These include GPS chips, computer chips, and cameras that allowed us to shrink that stuff, along with batteries, small enough so that we could put it on a flying machine that wasn't huge, right? And the drones that we all operate, and this includes those of us in our labs, are really different than the military ones. They cannot stay up for hours upon hours, right? We have to fly them generally in a place where legally, well, at least we need to see them, but also to operate them under control. We have to have line of sight. We don't have a $1 billion communication network. So they share some similarities to military drones, but really they're quite different. And then we've just seen this proliferation within the last few years, right, of kids and adults and everyone just buying these things for both hobby aspects, like you said, going out and do some fall foliage, but also what we do, which is on the mapping side, and the difference in the technology between just someone snapping a picture and someone who wants to create hundreds of pictures and bring those pictures together to make a map can be rather stark.
I'm sure that's the case. In the spatial analysis lab is part of the School of Engineering, or where does that actually reside at UVM?
Yeah, we're actually based in natural resources.
But I see.
The students that we pull from come from across campus. They may be engineers. They may be computer scientists. On our team, we have engineers, we have people with forestry degrees, wildlife degrees. We even have people who have majored in linguistics and fine arts, so people with art degrees who understand photography and lighting. Really, really useful for a group like us that makes use of drone technology.
That's fascinating. And so you got selected by the FAA to be part of its Center of Excellence on this topic, and I'm just wondering what that process was like and what that means to you.
Yeah, so here at UVM, I think I mentioned, you know, we really got into drone technology following Tropical Storm Irene. So what happened then is, people may recall, a lot of our state offices in Waterbury got flooded. And in a small state in Vermont, we have a great working relationship with our state agencies. And so when they were incapacitated, we took over a lot of the mapping activities, making sure that FEMA had the latest and greatest Vermont digital data sets and things like that. And I also had a military background, and I knew a lot about the satellites up there and had working relationships with the government agencies that were helping to acquire the data, but we just couldn't get it quickly enough. And so we really jumped on this idea that we needed to do this in a better way. And so we had some funding from the U.S. Department of Transportation, and we worked with communities and agencies throughout Vermont to use drones for a lot of transportation-related things, built especially around disaster response, and we worked with FEMA. And so that naturally led to relationships with other universities, and so we're really proud to be part of this FAA Center of Excellence, sort of look at, you know, how do we integrate drones into disaster response, everything from the big federal disasters like the major hurricanes that we see, or maybe it's down to just a local flooding event or fire within a Vermont town.
Well, you know, I can imagine that in a disaster response situation, drones would be really key. I remember I was actually working for the Associated Press and was on duty that Sunday that Tropical Storm Irene hit, and sitting in our Montpelier bureau, which was right by the Winooski River, getting a little nervous as I was hearing reports that the Marshfield Dam, 15 miles or so upstream, might be getting undermined and could send an 8-foot wall of water down to where I was. That didn't sound like very much fun. And one of the things that strikes me about this is that if I was with the utility, the Green Mountain Power owned the dam, if I were with the utility, I would not want to send one of my crew members out walking across the top of the dam to see how it was doing.
Yeah,
especially if it's being undermined. I might like to send a drone out there instead.
Yeah, absolutely. And drones work great in those cases where things are dangerous, dirty, or difficult, right? And this can be anything, like you said. We've got floodwaters, and we need to see if that dam is showing structural weaknesses. Maybe we need to do a bridge inspection, or maybe it's something else. We worked with the town of Plainfield on mapping their streams and looking at where the banks are eroding and the woody debris in there that impacts the downstream bridges and things like that. These are all great cases for drones, but there's also risk, because these are little flying machines that are entering the airspace, and the airspace has been typically occupied by manned aircraft, right? People in planes who are licensed. So this posed some real challenges for the FAA from a regulatory standpoint.
Yeah, and so how do you sort of balance those uses?
Yes, well, so the FAA is a regulatory agency, and they are concerned above all about safety, right? And so I think in the early days of drones, what we saw is that the FAA just said, you know, we don't want people flying drones. This wasn't exactly what they said, but it was really difficult to fly drones. The downside is when you make it incredibly difficult, that means perhaps that, you know, local fire department or that state emergency management agency, where drones could perhaps save life or save property or help people make better decisions, you really limit that capabilities. And to FAA's credit, what we've seen in the last several years in working with universities like ours is looking for that feedback. What should our regulations be going forward? How can we have pilots who are licensed to operate effectively? And then looking forward, you know, how can we have these drones perhaps communicate with aircraft so that everyone knows where things are? And you can imagine in a disaster, right, like, yeah, maybe it's just a fire in a town and it's just a drone. But in a major thing, maybe we've got news helicopters up there or news drones. We've got multiple organizations flying drones, right? We've got planes up there, right? The airspace can get crowded. Search and rescue, it can get complicated.
Yeah.
Where we need to advance both the regulations and the technology.
I mean, I suppose, you know, to use this case of the Marshfield Dam again, if the dam were reportedly being undermined by high water and there's worry about flooding downstream if the dam releases, obviously that would be a key story that a lot of the media would want to report that afternoon. So now we have not just the Green Mountain Power drone cruising around on top of the dam, but now we have the WCAX drone and the WPTZ drone and maybe the WDEV drone, you know. How do you manage that?
Yeah, and that's really, you just nailed it on what kind of like the future issues are, because right now you kind of just hope people are out there, but most of our drones are not talking to each other. It's you've got your controller, maybe you've got an iPad so you can get some video, and you're kind of hoping you don't run into each other. Now, if your two drones run into each other and maybe they're nice, you know, sort of these DJI Phantom drones that cost around $1,200, and they run into each other and one ends up on the ground, you know, that's a loss, but it's not hurting someone. But going with the future, you know, if we add a search and rescue helicopter in there, right, or something else, then we're potentially putting people at risk. And so the future of the technology and the future of the regulations is going to require that we either partition the airspace, and I mean by that we say, you know, you can only fly above this particular altitude, and, you know, we keep traditional piloted aircraft about this altitude, or ideally in the future, looking at technology that allow our drones to communicate with each other, just like a lot of our aircraft do right now with responders and things like that.
Jarloth, does the SAL do a lot of what used to be called GIS, Geographic Information Systems?
Yeah, we do. And like I said, we've always made use of this aerial and satellite imagery to do that. And the real change actually has not been just drones, right? But what our drones can do is we can go out and we can capture hundreds or thousands of pictures of a given area.
Mm-hmm.
And using our computer software now, we can take all those pictures and stitch them together. And the advances in computer processing mean that the computer can automatically find the matching locations between those photos to bring them together. So we can go out and fly, you know, maybe someone in Plainfield needs help with monitoring stream erosion. We can fly that stream in the morning, and by the afternoon, not only have a map of the area, but because the photos are taken from different perspectives, we can also produce a 3D model with incredible accuracy. So the drones themselves are cool, but also the back-end technology that allows us to do analysis from them and integrate it into our GIS, our mapping software, is really amazing.
And that might actually be something to bring that kind of speed to the analysis. There has got to be a beautiful thing from the point of view of somebody who might want to clear some growing debris pile out of a spot in a stream that could result in flooding by evening, right?
Yeah, it's incredibly powerful for that. Or, you know, sometimes we've got great overhead mapping programs in the state, but anytime we do those, right, the data takes months to arrive. And
yeah.
Something goes in and the stream changes course and maybe you need a new floodplain map. That's where drones can come in. Drones are not going to map the state of Vermont. They're not going to map your entire town. But for those areas where you need monitoring over time, and that could be, you know, maybe you're just a farmer and you want to monitor your crops, or you want to have evidence that your fields got flooded, right, so you can file a claim with the federal government.
Yep.
Drones can do all those types of things.
Wow. Hey, we do have a couple callers on the line. I think Tom from Brookfield was first. Good morning, Tom.
Well, good morning. Great show.
Thanks.
As you know, with some experience in this area, just like any new technology, whenever we institute a new technology, we have to kind of figure it out because the rules come after the technology. Just like the Grand Canyon crash back in 1954 of two airliners was the predecessor of the National Airspace System. Unfortunately, with these unmanned vehicles, these drones, UAVs, whatever, there's going to be some of those types of incidents that we can't even really anticipate right now that's going to cause new or changing regulation about airspace, as your guest was talking about, the segmenting of airspace, the being able to talk to each other like ADS-B, which is common in general aviation aircraft now. My other concerns, you know, are that it's not the commercial drone operators, it's not the professionals per se, it is the amateurs who can get a hold of pretty high level technology without understanding the implications of operating them near airports or, you know, the privacy concerns or any of the other issues that a commercial drone operator, somebody who actually has something to lose, a certificate with the FAA, they tend to think, wow, there could be ramifications of this, where the dude who goes out and buys a, you know, $1,200, or, you know, you can buy a $4,000 drone right now. So, you know, if you have enough money, you can go buy something that's pretty heavy and can do some damage and can cause some interference with, air rescue operations or firefighting or that type of thing, or even privacy concerns. You're hovering it above your neighbor's yard, the pool. There's going to be problems. So there's going to be a tremendous amount of change to the regulations as incidents happen, and hopefully it doesn't cause a problem that, you know, there's too much of a draconian
pushback, you know, reaction.
Yeah.
Hey, I got to go on to a couple other callers, and I also have a question myself for Jarlath. Thank you for the call, Tom. Appreciate it. Jarlath, let me ask you if I could... are there any laws right now about, I mean, this issue of drone-based sort of voyeurism or something? Your sunbather, your neighbor sunbathing in not much clothing, let's say, behind the hedge that used to be considered private, and now the drone goes up. What happens?
Yeah, there's really not too much, especially at the federal level, and the reason is that airspace is controlled by the federal government. And drones, on some extent, they're very similar. So when we go out and we do a mapping mission, we program the drone, we launch it, it goes out and maps the area. We're not even getting a real-time image feed from it. But some of these other drones that we have, right, they're surveillance or reconnaissance systems. They can feed back real-time data. The person can make adjustments on that. That's a real change for us in terms of aerial mapping. But I'll also mention that we have dozens of satellites up there right now. You could also do some of these very similar voyeurism or invasion of privacy with setting up a webcam or using a telephoto lens. So I always caution people to say, you know, it's not the drone. The drone is just the platform. We've got to look at how are we invading people's privacy. And you shouldn't be able to, you know, monitor me in my bedroom, regardless if it's a drone or a webcam that you set up in a tree or using your telephoto lens, right?
Sure, yeah.
We expect that, and we shouldn't get wrapped up in the fact that just because it's a flying machine, right? The problem is imagery of me in my bedroom.
Absolutely, yeah. It's the underlying offense. Let's go to Stuart in Worcester. Good morning, Stuart.
I have a couple of questions that are actually related to just the spatial analysis lab, but drone related too. I'm wondering if there's any access to data that's been, or images that are collected by these drones. In other words, you've made maps, you've got projects, you know, are they open to public viewing?
Yeah, in fact, many of them are. We share them with collaborators. In Vermont, we have the Vermont Center for Geographic Information. They've turned some of our data and made what are called web services. You can view them online. And we also have some online map viewers as well from from projects. And when you look at these data sets, which just look like a map of aerial imagery, one thing to keep in mind is there's often hundreds or thousands of photos driving those.
But, I mean, can we log into your website and view drone images?
So we don't always have them collected there. They are project-specific, but, you know, with a name like Jarlath, I'm easy to find on the UVM directory, and if you want to send me an email, I can send you some of our web applications.
Okay, one other quick question related to spatial analysis. There is LIDAR images for much of Vermont, yet access to that data is difficult for the public. Do you provide help with that?
So, for listeners who are not familiar, LIDAR, short for light detection and ranging, is a 3D mapping technology. The Vermont Center for Geographic Information, I think, does a very nice job of making those data sets available. The challenge with those data is they're very, very, very large. So sometimes if you want to view these 3D models, you need fancy computer systems, fancy software. But they do have some web applications that allow you to take a look at those data directly from your phone. And we've worked with them actually to turn those data into information, such as we just released a land cover map of Vermont that's over 1,000 times more detailed than anything ever before, thanks to LIDAR data.
Okay, so you're kind of recommending going through VCGI.
Yeah, VCGI, and take a look at their web services. You know, the challenge is nowadays there's so much data out there, so it can be tough to find what you're looking for. But they've got some nice online web applications that will allow you to see some of those LIDAR products.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, you're
thanks for the call, Stuart. A lot of good questions. It's great to have listeners call in who know a lot more about the subject than your humble host does, and can really zero in and raise some issues that I wouldn't have thought of. That's one of the great things about a call-in show. I really appreciate that. I learn stuff every day here on the Dave Graham Show, and so it's a real privilege for me, and I hope listeners learn stuff as well. I wanted to ask you, Jarlath O'Neill Dunn of the Spatial Analysis Lab, and more importantly, I guess, for today's conversation, not only of the Spatial Analysis Lab, but of the FAA Center of Excellence on the subject of drone technology and how it should be regulated into the future. Is the FAA in the process of sort of drafting rules? And I know a lot of federal agencies go through this iterative process of public comments and et cetera, et cetera. Is there a process like that going on? And if so, where is it right now?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I certainly don't want to speak for the FAA, but they've continued to modify the rules and regulations surrounding drones. And like I said, early on, it was extremely restrictive. And we've seen now to the part where we have what is called this Part 107, or these licensing requirements for commercial drone operators. And then some of the things that the FAA is looking at next is, how do we have a system that allows people to fly drones in ways that are not legally permitted without a waiver? So these are things that what we called beyond line of sight, being able to fly your drone and map areas where you cannot even see the drone anymore, which could be very useful for disaster response in Vermont, where with all our topography, right, it's pretty easy to lose sight of your drone, but the drones can be programmed to be smart enough to go capture data of an area and come back. Other things are how we can fly drones safely over people and vehicles, things that are right now not permitted without either notifying those people or a waiver. And are there certain types of drones that will be safe to do that? Or are there certain things we can do, like a company right now is putting parachutes on drones, where we can modify our drones so that they are safe? Because like I think Tom before was talking about, you know, the dangers of these flying drones, even if you have a 1 to 2 pound drone, doesn't sound like a big deal, but that thing falls from 300 feet, that can do some real damage.
Oh, sure.
Kill someone.
How close are we to getting our Amazon packages delivered by drone?
That's definitely a question better targeted at Amazon. You know, I think we've got a number of issues there. You know, one is the airspace, right, and how do we do this safely and effectively? The other issues are, you know, how do we do this that's reliable? You know, the biggest limitation a lot of us are finding in our lives with our cell phones and our laptops, batteries, right? The same thing happens with drones, and batteries are probably the limiting factor, and can we do that reliably and safely, and then can we have these drones talking to each other? So, you know, if you can go on online. You can watch the videos. Amazon's doing these test cases. But, you know, in these urban areas where you've got a 3D landscape and it's already complex, and that's where all the package delivery happens, New York City, you've got these major airports, you know, I think we're many years away from being able to see something like that that's fully automated.
Okay, I'm predicting drone traffic jams by the middle of the century, but we'll work on that when it happens. Hey, Jarlath O'Neill Dunn of the Spatial Analysis Lab at the University of Vermont. Fascinating conversation. I really appreciate you joining me this morning, and we'll perhaps touch base about this as the rules develop and the technology develops, and it's a fascinating future, folks. Stay with it. Stay with the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV, and we will be back after a top of the hour break for some CBS News.
Fall, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co., fashion-forward Tonya De Bellis, and comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
And we are back for the second hour of our program on this Tuesday, October 1st, 2019. And our good friends at Talk Media News are shaking up their organization a little bit. I'm not exactly sure of what's going to come out in the wash down there, but they are, the bottom line for us this morning is they are not available to us this morning. So we are going to be trying to figure out what the future holds for those folks. I've really enjoyed over the year and a half I've been doing this hosting of the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, our daily conversations with our friends Tom Squirteri and Bob Ney and the rest of the crew at Talk Media News, and hope we can get that resumed sometime soon. We'll keep you posted. That's the best I can tell you about that. Since normally after the mid-morning show, we go to a little bit of a national news here. I'm just going to let you know a couple things that are playing out there. Luckily enough, I'm able to get a collection of a wide range of news topics and subjects. Apple News is really handy when you're a radio talk show host, I got to tell you, folks. And one of the interesting stories here that's been running in the last day or so is that President Trump is demanding to meet the whistleblower at the center of the impeachment inquiry. And I'm going to be asking our incoming guest, Dan Richardson, is going to be joining us around the quarter hour, 10:15 or so. This is an old standard in American law that the accused gets to meet his or her accuser. And usually that means you look each other, you stare each other down essentially in a court of law. You know, the accuser is sitting in the defendant's dock and the accused may be on the witness stand and saying, yes, this is the person who did whatever crime to me that the person is being tried for. And the accuser, or rather the accused, is able of obviously to testify as well. That's a very formal proceeding that happens in a courtroom. I'm not exactly sure what the president has in mind here when he's talking about, he says, like every American, I deserve to meet. And by the way, this is a report from The Hill, terrific Capitol Hill-based, Washington-based publication that does a lot of stuff online these days, as most media outlets do. The president says, like every American, I deserve to meet my accuser, especially when this accuser, the so-called whistleblower, represented a perfect conversation with a foreign leader in a totally inaccurate and fraudulent way. Then Schiff, that's the Representative Adam Schiff, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee. Then Schiff made up what I actually said by lying to Congress, Trump said in a series of tweets. His lies were made in perhaps the most blatant and sinister manner ever seen in the great chamber, he continued, before adding that he wants Schiff, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, quote, questioned at the highest level for fraud and treason. And so we'll have to see what unfolds in terms of all the questioning of the House committee chairs for fraud and treason, et cetera. They are Adam Schiff, the representative from California, who chairs the House Intelligence Committee, has certainly been highly critical of the president, and that dates at least back to the Mueller hearings. I remember a speech he gave at the beginning of the day of Robert Mueller's testimony earlier this summer, and Schiff really came across as quite a prosecutor, outlining all of the various offenses he considered the president to have committed and the people around the president, et cetera. And I'm wondering if listeners think that's the proper role for a House Intelligence Committee chair. Is there that oversight role there that allows the Intelligence Committee chair to issue some very pointed criticisms at the president of the United States? The president is convinced that people who criticize him, it seems, are quote-unquote enemies of the American people. That's a phrase he directs at the media quite a bit. I think he lumps the media and the Democrats in Congress together in that same enemies of the American people category. Does criticizing the president in a democracy make you an enemy of the American people, or is that a fundamental function of a republic that is always in the search for a more perfect union? I sometimes think the way you get more perfect is by allowing the voicing of criticism in the country. But we now have a president who says criticism directed at least at the president makes you an enemy of the American people. I'm always eager to hear from our listeners here at WDEV. 244-1777 is the local number here in Waterbury, 1-877-291-8255. The polls would indicate, and the election results of 2016 would indicate, there are a lot of Vermonters out there who are not particularly fond of this president, maybe don't agree with him on policy or tactics or just general style. Lots of things you hear that are essentially criticisms of the president. Those of you out there who I see on Facebook and Twitter quite a bit criticizing the president, do you feel like you are enemies of the American people, or does that moniker not really apply? Eager to hear from folks out there who want to tell us what they think about that. This is the president accusing also the chair of the House Intelligence Committee of fraud and treason. Now, treason is a very specific crime. In fact, several months ago, I sort of looked it up because there were some allegations that maybe the president was guilty of treason in his dealings with Russia, et cetera. I wasn't at all convinced that the president was guilty of treason. Back then, treason actually involves a sharing of information or working with an enemy at a time of war. You have to be actually at war with that specific enemy, from what I understand is the correct reading of the Constitution, that for the crime of treason to be charged against you. And clearly the president was not in that particular circumstance. I would say it's equally clear right now that Adam Schiff is not in that particular circumstance, nor are any of the House members, nor is the whistleblower. The whistleblower can't be charged with treason because, again, treason is a crime that occurs during a time of war against a specific enemy, and the specific enemy has to be the entity that is being helped by the alleged treason. And so I think that word tends to get tossed around a little, perhaps too loosely sometimes. And this would be perhaps one of those instances. But I'm always curious to hear what listeners think. Do you out there think that anybody out there think that Adam Schiff is acting in a treasonous manner? Does anybody out there think the president has been acting in a treasonous manner? Maybe I'm wrong about this. It wouldn't be the first time. And I'm always happy to be to have somebody call up and disagree with me. That's part of the give and take here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. FM and AM. And once again, 244-1777 is the local number in Waterbury, the toll-free number, 1-877-291-8255. And I don't mind voicing either criticism or defense of the president. I've had a range of guests on doing either one from time to time, and obviously the callers get to decide for yourselves what you think about all this. So let's go to one right now. Rama from Williamstown is on the line. Good morning, Rama.
Yeah, at
the heart of this, and remember, this isn't about Trump, as I try to keep reminding people, is Trump is a product of the Republican Party. The Republican Party is not a product of Trump. He reflects them, their values, and their intentions quite perfectly, and that's why they're willing to just circle wagons so closely around him, no matter what he does. But this is about values. This is about openness in government, which Trump hates. This is about honesty, which Trump hates. This is about not being racist, which Trump hates. This is about not being misogynist, which Trump hates. And by the way, every time I say which Trump hates, it also means which the Republican Party hates. This is about protecting our Constitution, which Trump and the Republicans hate.
Rob, I'm going to give you a little bit of pushback there. I don't imagine that every Republican, every person who is identified as a Republican in our listening area or nationwide is on the board with hating the things you say Trump hates exactly to the same degree. I think there's a wide variation among Republicans, some of whom remember prominent ones, George Will, David Frum, Bill Weld. You could go down a list, which is way longer than the names we've all heard of. But there are quite a number of Republicans out there who are not fans of this particular president. Now, I know what you're saying, where some of the tendencies in the Republican Party over the years may have gotten us to this point where Trump could get elected. But I don't think that the specific traits of this guy are universal to the Republican Party.
Well, you use the same excuse when we talk about the Catholic
Church.
Okay? Yeah. And you say, well, not every Catholic. Well, listen, if you belong to the organization,
yep,
you support the organization, and you stand by what the organization does simply because it's the organization, you're supporting what is happening. Period. You can't separate enabling from active participation. They're both the same thing.
That's why I left the Catholic Church. I do ask my Republican friends, you know, when the president does something that strikes me, and I would think in their better moments, them as rather egregious, whether it's telling four congresswomen of color to go back to where they came from or whatever, I say to my friends who support the president, I say, how do you work that out in your own mind that you can actually do this and stick with this guy when he's doing and saying things like this? I think it's a legitimate question, one which has to be asked, but I don't go so far as then saying because they are defending him or saying they like him on trade. I had a guy emailing me yesterday saying really likes Trump on trade, and so he's willing to put up with a lot of stuff.
Well, there's your answer.
Yep.
Quote, put up with. In other words, you're saying put up with. I'm saying they actually support because, you know,
yeah,
they listen. If I'm supporting the local mass murderer because he gives me $50 a month, I'm supporting the local mass murderer.
Okay.
I went to something vile as quick as I could here.
Yeah.
Not accusing anybody of being a mass murderer.
Okay, but and here's the other thing strategically, Rahm. I would think, you know, as a liberal or a Democrat or whatever.
Well, wait a minute, back up.
I'm not a Democrat.
If you want me to explain where I am politically, I'll be happy to, but please don't apply labels to me because I don't accept either of those.
Okay, all right. But if you want to criticize the president and change direction in this country, it seems as though you might want to think about a way in terms of the rhetoric that you use to approach the people who maybe voted for Trump last time and feel like they need to defend him or whatever. And I know this is going to sound crazy to you, but in a slightly friendlier manner, basically you're trying to bring around a closer to your point of view. I think that you need to remember that there's still more similarities than differences, I am pretty sure.
Well, first off, is I work with a lot of people on a regular basis who I have huge disagreements on these issues.
Yep.
So I do that on a regular basis.
Okay, good.
And I do not bring these discussions into where we have a common job to perform.
Yeah,
and I don't do it for that specific reason, so we don't end up just sitting there steaming at each other. However, I will not, if you stop me on the street and ask me about these, how I'm talking to you now is
yep,
the exact same way I will answer John Doe down the hill from here.
Got it.
Because
You know, listen, I've watched the Republican Party for decades now. At one point, I could have voted for George H.W. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
I really could have. But then when Ron Reagan came out with his bit about the welfare queen, and I had a sister at that time who was on welfare, and, you know, this is a woman who over the course of her life had gone from public assistance to being what you would call self-sufficient to actually doing a lot to help out other people. But, you know, when Ronald Reagan called her and her ilk welfare queens because they needed some temporary assistance, that turned me against him specifically. And then when the Republican Party picked up that mantle of going after poor people, it turned me against the Republican Party.
Yeah.
I am not pro-Democratic Party by any stretch of the imagination. And I actually, more than liberal, I'm probably more libertarian than anything else if you want to put me in a big box. But you know, none of the truth is, when you sit down with me or you or anybody else, very few of us, if any of us, actually fit into some neat little box.
That's
but
true.
I can tell you, though, when you're supporting an organization that does something, you're supporting what that organization does. And if the Republican Party is circling its wagons around a misogynist, racist, lying, willfully ignorant individual with an authoritarian worldview, that's what they're supporting because that's what they're defending.
All right, Robin, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. I think you've made your point. We're going to move on. Glad to have and be able to introduce my next guest, who is Dan Richardson. Dan is a former president of the Vermont Bar Association, prominent Montpelier attorney, involved in a lot of different issues here in Vermont, also a close student of what's going on at the federal level. And I think we're going to focus some on that this morning, given that there is so much going on in the federal level which touches on the law. And we'll get to that in a couple of minutes. First, I wanted to bring in a caller who gives a ring during the break. And Vicki from Williston joins us. Good morning, Vicki.
Yeah, hi. First of all, I wanted to tell you that I really enjoy your show. I don't usually listen to talk radio because I feel people are always screaming. And
thank you very much. How's that for a scream?
That's right. I think you present thought-provoking topics in a very respectful manner. And the other thing I want to say, just as in response to the last gentleman's call, you know, I somewhat agree with him. I think I have friends who support Trump, and we just don't talk about it anymore.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Well, we're beyond that.
Right?
Yep. People aren't changing on either side. But I think you're also beyond political views, which you're talking about with some of the current administration is involved in, is my morals, my philosophies, my way of life. And now you're really stepping on out of the political arena into things that mean a lot to me. So I think that becomes a lot more emotional to people such as myself. And I just think we're in a different time now.
Yeah,
so
you know,
Vicki,
I think you're right about that. And I mean, one of the things that has been bothering me is that I actually am frequently bothered by the president's behavior as much as policy and or ideology. I mean, I do disagree with some of his stuff on policy, climate change, for instance, and other things, but the behavioral stuff, you know, when he labels or he says to four women of color who are members of Congress that they should go back where they came from, when he calls neo-Nazis marching on Charlottesville very fine people, all these different instances of. And I've said repeatedly on the program here that if Bernie Sanders had somehow gotten elected and president in 2016 and, you know, had been talking about grabbing women by their private parts, I'd be on Bernie Sanders' case about that, too. Or even it goes so far as people talk about we need to have more respect for the presidency because, you know, he's in the White House, this very important institution in our country. And then he goes out on the public stump and uses words like BS. I won't say the specific word, but you know what I mean. And when he uses language like that, or s-hole countries or whatever, I think that actually diminishes the respect that the White House is getting from its current occupant. And that just, that lowers the discourse all the way around. And it's it's unfortunate. So, but I thank you for the call, Vicki. Interesting thoughts, and don't be a stranger. Check in with us again. My next guest, Dan Richardson, as I mentioned, is a prominent lawyer in Montpelier and is a frequent guest on the Dave Graham Show on legal issues. And he's getting to be I love the way some of the cable shows on TV round up a group of lawyers, and Dan's ours. So we like having Dan come by and tell us what he thinks. Dan, one thing I wanted to clear up right off the bat is the definition of treason, because I'm not a lawyer. Maybe you can help me out with this, but the president is accusing Adam Schiff, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, of treason and fraud. Is Adam Schiff guilty of either of these crimes?
No. No, it's very clear. And so there's a number of reasons why Trump is doing this. But let's start with the definition of treason. Treason against – it's actually defined in the Constitution. It's one of those rare cases where we can look to the document and have the answer. And treason, mm-hmm. treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. And it says that no person shall be convicted of treason unless on the testimony of two witnesses to the same overt act or in confession in open court. So what that means is that treason only occurs during wartime. It only occurs when we give comfort to the enemies of the United States as a country that are attacking us, or assistance to them. So Trump's allegations against Schiff really don't meet that definition. Schiff basically paraphrased, parodied, misstated, however you want to characterize his opening statements, Trump's call with the Ukrainian president. That's not treason as defined in the Constitution. It may be treasonous to Trump personally, but that's not what treason is under the Constitution. Now, why is Trump raising treason? That's because the only crime that a so there's a doctrine known as legislative immunity, which says that legislators, when they're on the floor, when they're working, cannot be accused of a crime vis-a-vis their acts in Congress. So they have immunity from that. So you couldn't sue a congressman for making a quote-unquote defamatory statement through a committee hearing. And so – but the one exception to that is treason. And, you know, in a sort of ham-fisted way, the president has grabbed onto this concept and has sort of, you know, boldly led with it without necessarily understanding the nuance. Now, the definition of treason in common parlance has more wider meaning. It's a more general synonym for disloyalty, which is clearly what I think the president is pushing when he uses this term, and emphasizing as if, you know, if you say something bad about the president, the office of the person occupying the office of the president, you're somehow being disloyal to the United States. And frankly, that's not what the founders intended with the word treason put into the Constitution. And that's not really an American sense of the word treason.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very specific thing. It doesn't. It's not a crime that is prosecuted. I mean, it's prosecuted very, very rarely. Is that correct?
It is. It's a bit like perjury in the sense that, you know, it requires such a high level of proof that there have been only a few notable instances where the evidence of people's quote-unquote treasonous behavior has risen to the standard that has been allowable and admissible in court and sustained as a basis for such an allegation of treason. You know, it really does require overt acts or an open confession that you intended to give aid and comfort to the enemy. And, you know, there is that limitation. I mean, the key word there is only. And, you know, if you read some articles about this and that scholars have published, you know, the founders were particularly sensitive about the concept of treason, because the word treason in the pre in the colonial era and before, was often used as a tool to stymie or stifle dissent. And so if you spoke against the king, you were treasonous. You know, whether or not you were just complaining about the taxes or the policies that the king was enacting internally, the word treason, the concept treason, was bandied about as a way of keeping people from voicing their dissent openly. And the founders were very aware of this and very sensitive to it. And so when they defined treason, they wanted to limit its applicability. And so, you know, what Trump is doing in his tweets is exactly what I think the founders intended treason not to be.
And do you think it might be the case that the founders actually were aware of this danger that disloyalty would be sort of melded with treason, and that's why they mentioned this specific crime in the Constitution? They want to put a very small box around it.
I think absolutely. I mean, you have to realize that the founders, of course, were, you know, students of history and were aware of the recent British history that had been, you know, everything from the British Civil War, you know, where you had the loyalists to the king and the Puritans revolting, the Roundheads, to even the politics of British government in their day in the 1700s, that, you know, there was a lot of use of treason to stifle this type of dissent. And so they did. They wanted to put it in a very clear black box to limit its use. They did want to be able to punish if somebody was disloyal. You know, they were forming a new nation and loyalties hadn't quite sugared out yet. And so they did want to make it a punishable crime, but they wanted to keep it limited. And and so, you know, I think they were very clear. And, you know, when you look into the Constitution, there are things there that are maddeningly vague. you know, the process of impeachment itself is not very well laid out in the Constitution. But, you know, there are these small glimmers where the founders chose to make these very clear definitions to limit the power as a framing tool. And don't forget, the Constitution is vague on purpose because it's a framing tool, not a statutory structure that would be more specific. And so, you know, when the founders limit something in this framing tool, they really mean it.
Yeah, that's an important consideration. When you use the word framing, I mean, I've heard the founders described as framers. That's another sort of another term people apply. But I started to think about construction of a house, and you could say that the statutory framework that or the framing tool is the beams and so on and the rafters of the house, and then the finished carpentry is going to be your statutory stuff.
Exactly.
Maybe a good metaphor. I don't know. Let's take a brief break here on the Dave Graham Show. Folks, you want to line up some calls for us? Dan Richardson is here, eager to take your questions. 244-1777 is the local number here in Waterbury, the toll-free number, 1-877-291-8255 or 291-TALK. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Fall, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co. to fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis and Comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
Had a political scientist on, Lisa Holmes from the University of Vermont, yesterday, and who was really kind of emphasizing the political science aspects of impeachment and how it sort of plays and when what the people's reading of the situation. And I was pushing back on Ms. Holmes or Professor Holmes a little bit and just saying, well, there are some facts in play too here, right? And we got into a little conversation about that. I also mentioned to her that our good friend of the show, Guy Page, the other day posted something on his blog, I think one of his blogs, the State House Headliners, saying essentially that what you see depends on where you stand. And I was pushing back on that too. I mean, I really do think that at some point we do have to resort to what are the facts of the matter. And just let's go back to the question of treason, punishable by death under the Constitution. Is that right?
That is correct.
Dan, and I wonder if you could tell me, the President of the United States, by saying that Adam Schiff, one of his leading critics in Congress, is acting treasonously. Is he suggesting that Schiff should die?
Well, I mean, you know, that's a little bit of an extension, and but the implication is there. I mean, you know, anytime you bandy about the word treason in this context, it does carry that ultimate conclusion that if someone is in fact guilty of treason, they are eligible for the death penalty.
So we established in our conversation a few minutes ago that Adam Schiff is not guilty of treason or nothing like it, really. The underlying conditions, including that the United States be at war against a specific enemy with which this person would be working, is just not there. So to accuse him of treason, a crime that carries a death penalty, that's going to be somewhat intimidating, doesn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, and maybe not Adam Schiff. You know, he sits as chair of the House Intelligence Committee. You know, he has a staff of lawyers who are going to, you know, tell him a lot of what we've been talking about in much greater detail. So he is probably not losing sleep over this. But if you're in the sort of general pool of people that are likely affected by this this case, a potential witness or somewhat marginally involved, I mean, this is frightening because it does raise the stakes. And it's the classic Trumpian counterpunch. You know, when you defend people in court, you know, there are often two strategies. One is to, show your client to be the most reasonable person and, you know, that these grounds against them are unfounded. And the other is to counterpunch and to punch back hard and to basically put the prosecution on trial. And Trump has never, ever adopted the former strategy. He's always adopted the latter. And so, you know, he's trying to do that because what that does is it causes the prosecutor to make mistakes. And, you know, some people have criticized Schiff's opening statements as a quote-unquote mistake in this respect, and I'll leave that to political scientists and analysts to decide whether or not it was. But it certainly shows that, you know, this kind of pressure brought back where, you know, the defense essentially is trying to conduct a countertrial against the prosecution can lead to, you know, the prosecution getting nervous, making mistakes, having public scrutiny, follow much closely and picking apart each side, as well as causing witnesses to feel intimidated that the stakes are simply too high and they will play it as safe as possible, if not, if in some ways trying not to play at all.
Since I brought it up, I really have to get us to the resolution also of this question of the role of facts here. I mean, would you agree with me that it's really not a case of what you see depends on where you stand?
Right. I mean, that's a very interesting relativist position.
Wow. Postmodernism on steroids or something.
Exactly. You know, it's the classic what is it is depends on what is means.
Yeah.
You know, these are fairly straightforward issues. And in some ways, that's why this has gained so much momentum so quickly, because this is not something where you have to go through a 500-page report to, parse through what the issues are, who was where and what. This is the president calling a foreign government, withholding foreign aid to that government, and making it seem as if such foreign aid will not come through unless they can do a favor for him, said favor being one that benefits him personally and in his political campaign.
Yeah, I think those are the big sort of signposts around this whole episode here. Another key difference with all this material in the Mueller report, I hate to say that Americans are not voracious readers or anything, but the Mueller report was 440-something pages, and the whistleblower report was 9 pages.
Right. Well, I mean, what was the last 500-page novel you read, David?
Well, I have to think about that, actually, now that you mention it. I think, though, that the Mueller report is if you compare the two, the whistleblower report and the Mueller report, and how the whole thing seems to be unfolding, the Mueller report really did end with kind of a whimper, didn't it? Because you get to the end of the thing and you say, okay, all these potential crimes in Section 1, all these clear instances of obstruction of justice, which is a crime in Section 2. And guess what? We can't prosecute the president, so never mind.
Right. I mean, it's a difference. The Mueller report was like Finnegan's Wake. It just folds back on itself, and it raises a lot of issues, and it's very interesting to go through, but it doesn't necessarily come to a conclusion. Whereas this nine-page report by the whistleblower is much more of a Dr. Seuss book than anyone can follow along.
Yeah.
You know, this is the problem, is that, you know, these reports, these lengthy, in-depth, detailed reports are very helpful. They're critical to how government functions. And we used to have a time, and it's not as if we suddenly can't read these reports or don't have the time. People have never had the time to read lengthy, very dense government reports. But we used to have I think we used to be able to rely upon interpreters, experts, who would read the report and tell us this is what it means.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in the sort of hyper-partisan charged atmosphere that we exist in and that we tend to view politics through, there is no such guide. Everybody has an agenda, an angle. And when that happens, then, you know, these reports become useless because there's no interpreter who can simplify it in a way that is generally accepted.
Well, I know that is the overall thrust, it seems, of the way we're handling these events. But I push back and I just say, let's at least note a fact here and there. Just try to punctuate this whole miasma of alleged political game playing. And one of them is two guys go to Ukraine separately. One is named Paul Manafort. The other is named Hunter Biden, right? Paul Manafort is now, here's a fact, sitting in a federal penitentiary. Hunter Biden is not. I think that what that says, I mean, it's a very shorthanded way of describing a situation here where they haven't really been able to find anything on Hunter Biden, and they found lots on Paul Manafort.
Yes. Well, I mean, it wasn't Paul Manafort's trip to Ukraine isn't why he's sitting in a prison. It's what he did with his trip to Ukraine and brought it and the way he used it, you know, in a way that was trying to promote the Ukraine government's and the pro-Russian factions of the Ukraine government's positions to the detriment of the United States in some respects, or at least in a way that was not disclosed and open. Whereas, you know, Hunter Biden, by all evidence, you know, worked for this company. Did he get a sweetheart deal and paid more? Well, I don't know. I don't know what the going rate for sitting on a board of a multinational oil company is, or what services he particularly rendered. But at the same time, there's no evidence that he interfered with the government or that his father interfered with the government on either's behalf. And, you know, that is something. It has been dug around. It has been looked at. You know, and in fact, some of the narrative starts to fall apart once the objective details come into place. You know, the very call that Vice President Biden made to remove a prosecutor wasn't because this prosecutor was being hyper-aggressive or was coming close to Hunter Biden. By all evidence, this was a prosecutor who was doing the opposite, and they were looking to replace that prosecutor with a more aggressive one. And in that respect, you know, it doesn't make sense that if you were in fact trying to do this to protect your son, that you would be removing the prosecutor that by all evidence would likely go easy if there was wrongdoing, to replace him with a more aggressive one.
Yeah. And I think the level of confidence that would have to be possessed by a Joe Biden to make that call when, in some people's estimation, is a potential target of a new and more aggressive prosecutor might be your own son. I think that says a lot, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, this is the thing, and I hate to go back to sort of this postmodernism theme that runs through, but, you know, that is the classic defense strategy of destabilizing the narrative. Make everybody doubt everything.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
When you're a defense attorney, the whole idea is to make you doubt your own name.
Yeah.
Because if you can't be sure about your own name, how can you be sure about these facts that happen outside of the courtroom? And, you know, who knows what truth is, and who knows if we're even here or if we're brains in a jar connected to a computer.
Right, yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen,
yeah.
I rest. But
I got to watch you do that in court sometime. Okay. And I'll get up on the witness stand and I'll say, when they say, do you swear to tell the whole truth, nothing but the truth? I'll say, no, I don't know the whole truth. And my version of the truth might be a dream and so on and so forth. Dan, do you think that if the president is demonstrated to have done what is alleged here, which is to make this phone call to the Ukraine, holding up military aid as the sort of what you're going to get if you help me, and then asking for this kind of help, is that an impeachable offense?
Well, that's a loaded question. And the answer to that is both yes and no. Yes, it passes the very broad definition of what is an impeachable offense, high crimes and misdemeanors, because that term is not defined. And certainly that is something that could be fitting within that ambit. You know, there's certainly no precedent that says it wouldn't. And the fact that if you have someone who is, as president, you know, using self-enriching or, you know, seeking self-enrichment through the functions of government, that certainly would fit within what the founders intended impeachment to cover. But impeachment is designed to be a political process. You know, it requires the House of Representatives to come up with articles of impeachment, vote on the articles of impeachment, and pass them to impeach the president. And then it requires a trial over in the Senate after the president has been impeached. And that's a political process on both sides. And the votes are, surprise, surprise, political. So you're not talking about a neutral jury in which, you know, if somebody's accused of a crime, they get a jury of their peers. And that jury is intended to be objective and neutral hearers of the fact. And the judge who sits and decides the law of the case is intended to be neutral and unbiased and an arbiter that is fair. The Senate isn't. The Senate is a political body. The House is a political body. So, yes, I mean, to the extent that this meets the definition, absolutely. To the extent that it goes far enough to convince Republicans to vote against the president of their own party, I don't know. It's an interesting question, and certainly, you know, there was a very telling statement, and I'm sure people have mentioned it, but supposedly Jeff Flake said that if the vote for impeachment was conducted anonymously, you'd get between 30 and 35 Republican senators voting to voting to uphold the impeachment.
Right.
But it's not. It's an open roll call. And everybody's vote is known. And, you know, the first impeachment that ever occurred, Andrew Johnson, when he was impeached by the Republican-controlled Congress, he survived being removed from office following his impeachment by a single vote.
Yeah.
And that was the determining, you know, factor. And it's an interesting counter history to consider if Johnson had been removed from office, because we've never had a president removed from office. And so in some respects, you know, there's a question of, you know, does a president ever have the will to do, does the Congress ever have the will to remove a president, and how bad would the president have to behave? And this is certainly an experiment, at least in outward bad behavior, but it's done during an extremely partisan period of time where people will vote not necessarily their personal beliefs, but their party loyalties.
Do you think it would be a legitimate question to ask at an upcoming Democratic presidential debate, each of the candidates on the stage? This is the question for the candidate. If you are elected, will you ask the Congress to pass, and will you sign when it gets to your desk, legislation eliminating the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel memo saying that a sitting president can't be prosecuted?
Well, yeah, that would be an interesting question. And I think some journalists have started to ask that question of some of the candidates. And, you know, as no surprise, everybody's a little noncommittal. I mean, that's a classic question of, will you accept this office with diminished powers? That's tricky. You know, it does raise these questions. And you know, in the 90s, things opened up, especially when Bill Clinton was being you know, sought after in a number of these civil lawsuits, the Paula Jones lawsuit, going through the Whitewater investigation that ultimately led to impeachment. You know, each and every one of those lawsuits, you know, it took time away from the president being the president. And certainly, you know, if there's a grain of validity in a lot of Trump's complaining, it is that this is taking up a huge amount of his time. Now, some people would say it was good that they took up Bill Clinton's time, that it's good they're taking up Trump's time because that's less time they can muck with either the economy or regulations or, you know, these other things that make them dangerous to whoever perceives that. But at the same time, you know, do we want, you know, given that lawsuits have these lives that continue, you know, a well-pled lawsuit can stick around for years and years.
Yeah.
And do we want the president to be enmeshed in that kind of ongoing litigation just by virtue of holding the office and just by virtue of living in very partisan times? You know, I don't think it's a healthy thing. And so in some respects, I think the president should have some protection so that he or she, like the Congress, can get down to the people's business.
What about the, I mean, since I'm in the business right now, these few minutes anyway, of just kind of blowing things up. What about the special counsel system in general? I sort of see it as starting out with a huge conflict of interest in that you have the executive branch essentially investigating itself. We saw all that through the whole, you know, James Comey, Robert Mueller, Rod Rosenstein conundrum, and the president occasionally threatening to fire people involved and so on. And here we have something which so far looks like a fairly simpler and maybe more effective process of the Congress saying, we're going to have an impeachment inquiry. Let's bring some people in to testify. We'll have a straight up or down vote whether the guy deserves to be impeached. Another straight up or down vote in the Senate whether he deserves to be removed from office. And why not just get back to what the Constitution ordered?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, you know, the Constitution didn't necessarily prohibit these things or require these things. And if you get too simple, then it'll be meaningless. You know, you can talk about how do you change the special counsel so it's more effective. And there's some, you know, if you contrast, I mean, Mueller was limited and took his charge seriously to be limited to what he was given authority to do. Think about the Ken Starr investigation of Clinton that started out at one point and expanded to a much larger circle of allegations and information.
Yeah.
It's a hard balancing act because, of course, if you're an investigator and you stumble upon new information, you want to pursue it. If you're but at the same time, we don't want people going on fishing expeditions and wild goose chases. And we also want the special counsels to be answerable to somebody. And, you know, I could see a system where Congress would have authority over these special counsels to do these investigations.
Hmm. Yeah, that would make a lot of sense to me, get it out of the executive branch, because that does strike me as a classic, you know, fox in a chicken house kind of situation there. But, well, I guess we're going to have to leave a lot of these issues for continuing discussion for your next appearance here on the Dave Graham Show. Dan Richardson, I thank you so much for joining me. Always an excellent conversation. Thank you for coming in.
Well, thanks for having me.
Alrighty, we're going to, just a minute or so to go, I want to leave to let you all know out there about our podcast. Don't forget about the podcast. If you missed part of the show today and you want to catch up, you can always go to WDEVradio.com, scroll down a bit, and you will find, go to WDEVradio.com, follow the link from there to the Dave Graham Show, and then you scroll down a bit, you find a list of our recent programs, and you can listen to your heart's content any time of day or night. And the Warren Store is the sponsor of our podcast. We thank the Warren Store, the friendly, funky, and almost world-famous Warren Store, for that very much. It's going to about do it for the Dave Graham Show on this Tuesday morning, October 1st. Thank you all for listening, and check us out again tomorrow morning. And have a great afternoon, everybody.